Well, now, if you all don't care, I'm just going to sit right here. Is that all right? I saw the president stand up and everybody else, so I thought maybe I was going to have to stand up. Well, I landed in Anchorage in 1915, which by the side of Fort Bisher makes me a teacher. But nevertheless, I've had a few good times and bad times in the years that I've been here. I remember very well, I left Colorado Springs coming west, and we stopped in San Francisco, and that looked pretty good to me, but I had a ticket through to Seattle, so I didn't stop there and came up, and the Northwestern had broken down when we got there, so we sat around in Seattle for 3 or 4 days, and we came up on the Admiral Evans, which you all probably remember. You do, Irving, that's for sure. And it was loaded to the gunwale, so was all right. We all had a bed to sleep on, or at least the floor wasn't too hard. I don't know why I had a cot. So I remember distinctly we got to Ketchikan, and the bartender said, came out and rang the bell and said, "All you guys come and have a drink." And so we wondered what this was all about. And he'd been on that run for 7 years, and by golly, that's the first time the sun had ever shone when he got into Ketchikan. So he brought everybody a drink. Well, I picked up a nickname on that trip. It's true that, as I told somebody the other day, I was raised by two old aunts back home, that if somebody had come along and said, "Get your gun, we're going after the Yanks," well, they would have each got their gun and away we'd gone, you know. Well, I was raised up in that kind of an atmosphere, and so they were playing a game on the Admiral Evans, trying to pass the time. You couldn't get in the library, you couldn't get anywhere. So I had been up a little late the night before, and I got up and I came to the social hall, as all of you that have traveled on the boat know about. And I said, "Well, what are y'all doing now?" And there was a gal named Inez Adams. The most I remember about her was that she was a perfect 36. That's what they called her. So, and she spoke up and said, "That guy must be from Dixie." Well, my dear people, I picked up a nickname then, and I've carried it ever since. I get half my mail in Dixie Hall.
What
are you born, Missouri. Huh? Yeah, in that part of Missouri where they still skip the battle of all the battles by then.
Missouri?
Yeah, yeah, see that.
And
he was a Republican.
He said on the north.
Oh, well, yeah, well, I know. There were lots of them. Well, on the boat up, there was an old boy going prospecting for Quicksilver. So this partner of mine from Colorado, I had sold out and he'd gotten hailed out. So by golly, we flipped a buck to see whether we'd go up, come up here, or go to South America. I wanted to go to South America, but he wanted to come up here. So we flipped a buck and it came here. So that's the reason that I got here. And he wanted to go up on the Talashalitna River prospecting. So I thought, by golly, I've chased cows all over Colorado, by golly, in the rain and the snow. I would rather, we were coming up to Homer to Homestead and the ranch. But this was where we wanted us to go. So, and he had an engine, and by golly, there was nothing to it. We'd rather make it to no fast by getting Quicksilver than we would by ranching. So we built this boat. And he had a two-cylinder Evinrude. Boy, I'll never forget that one. We rolled out in a barrel before we started. That was about 60 days. If any of you all remember those first things, believe me, that was the deal. So we finally got the thing to run. We built the boat and we put a ton of grub in it, and we started out to make a move. Well, we got across the inlet there and got over about 6 miles off the shore. And the smoking went high and dry. The tide was going out. I didn't know anything about that, and either this old man or my partner did. So, I took off my shoes and laid down and had a little sleep and fiddled around. And boy, when the tide came in, I didn't get a chance to put my shoes on. We were afloat. And that was on Pemmican Island, pretty near. It was right out there where if a board come along, they had to call us. And I'd often heard this thing about God looks after his children in twos. Well, I happened to be the two that time, and there were the other two of us. But anyway, it started to blow, and we got blown ashore. And I hadn't been in the country a couple of months till I saw moose. And Bill came down and visited us every day, fishing right just a little below us. And I thought, well, this is your God's country, by Jesus. So we stayed there, and we could get over to the mouth of the Susitna River. And there was a fellow by the name of Pop Weeks, who was on the old Matanuska boat. It was a gas boat, but it was a three-wheeler. And he ran from Anchorage up the Susitna River to Susitna Station, which was on the trail then from Seward over to Iditarod and over that way. And of course the trail north hadn't ever gone through yet. He was really passing that way. So he hollered at us and came and he hauled us up that far. Well, when the B&B boat, that is Barrington and Barrington, they built three tunnel boats that ran on the Susitna River. Well, they put all our stuff on and our boat and took us to Talkeetna. Well, that's where we started up the Talashalitna and the Squintna River. And we got up there, you know, and well, we were in God's country. We never had been a soul there before. Well, we got as far as we could. Every night, we'd rebabbit the pump on that doggone motor. And I being the largest and the worst man on the end of the tow line, I got to ride in the boat and keep us all shore, and the other guys were walking up the river, pulling his boat. Well, we got up there, and by golly, what do you think we found? We found a pile of whipsawed lumber that had been there for doggone long, you could pretty near poke your finger through it, by Jim. And here we were, thought the first ones there. Well, we lost that because we didn't know what we were looking for. The old man might have that sold us on this trip, but we didn't know, so we were up there for a month or 6 weeks and had a good time. Well, finally, we took a notion to come back down because it was getting towards fall. And so we got on, and the first thing we did when we got to Susitna Station was to get this engine and put it in the boat and roll out in the middle of the river and throw it overboard, and then thank the Almighty that we got rid of that thing anyway, by the way. Well, I went to work on the boat, and when they went into Anchorage, well, we went, there were two fellows I know. One of them name was Boat. That was an engineer. Well, I laugh, this is a little aside from the question, but if you take a New York Times, Seattle Papers or anything, every advertisement, there's page after page, engineers, every kind of, and both these fellows were both graduate civil engineers and couldn't get a job. They came up to run these gas boats by then. They couldn't get a job outside. So that shows how the engineer business has come to the front. But anyway, so I went into Anchorage and saw some of the fellows that had come up on the boat. So we got a tent and bogged down. There wasn't much grub in Anchorage that winter. And I always say we strangled rabbits to live that winter. And Mrs. Hall never did like that expression. He said, "Dick, that's terrible. You sound like you're murdering somebody to say you strangled rabbits." But that's what we lived on that winter. So the next spring, when we were going to live, Cap Lathrop was building the Empress Theater that summer. And the fellow that I was with was a carpenter, so he got a job carpentering, and he got me on as a carpenter helper. So, and old Cap was just like he was here. He was the first man on the job every morning, believe me, and if you weren't there, believe me, you got to go over. I found that out, too. But that was the first year in Lincoln. I'm trying to find my notes here. I'm like somebody I saw the other day here. Oh, yeah, here we go. There's a fellow, Cap Nelson. He was on one of these B&B boats going into town, and he wanted me to go back up on the river with him. So I did, and that's the first time I really got scared about being on water. I fell overboard once and happened to grab the gangplank and floated a little bit until I hit a shallow. And the next time there's the pilot on the boat, grabbed the pike pole and hooked me in the seat of the tank and pulled me on. So that was about the two times I ever fell in the river and drowned. And that river really blew me. That's just in the river. So that winter, after I did that, we spent the winter at Dead Horse. That's where still Curry. They named it Curry afterwards. But they had a sawmill there, and they put up a store and had a heck of a lot of stuff there. I know the bacon all spoiled. I remember that very well. Then in the spring, there was a fellow named Don Moxon guy with the P&T department, they called it thing. So Don, I said to Don, by golly, boy, this ain't going to get over and we aren't going to get to go anywhere. That is after the board started, after we'd gotten in. So we took a notion to go outside. So we did, and I was the most fortunate fellow that ever went into the Army, I think. At least that war. Because the day I went in, they formed the Motor Transport Corps of the 13th Division. And now, Paul can know this very well, and the rest of it have been in the service. Men that could ride in a typewriter was the scarcest thing that came into the Army. You remember that, don't you, Forbes? I went down to Depot Brigade every day looking for men. After I got back, I could write a little bit. They took me up to the Motor Transport Corps. I'd been rushing dogs that winter carrying mail between Talcate and Dead Horse, so I thought, by golly, I'm going to ride. And here were these big ads as big as this building. All the boys in the building and big Kelly trucks and everything. So, by golly, I'm going to ride. So, there was another Lieutenant Colonel Richmond Smith. I used to meet him on his door every morning because I had to have competent orders. My card had been sent back home, and you had to have competent orders to get in. So I'd come out from Alaska, and I didn't want to go broke and have to go to work out there, so I was on the old man's doorstep every morning. Finally, he said, "You Missouri so-and-so, I'm going to put you in the Army and get rid of you." So he did me up with these competent orders as a truck driver, and I said, "Lord, I don't know if it's the end of the truck to get on. What do you mean, this competent orders as a truck driver?" But anyway, they put me in the Motor Transport Corps of the 13th Division, and the fellow Brewer took me up there. He was the top cutter, and took me and introduced me to this Major, and I didn't have any more idea about military than the man in the moon. So he asked me if I could ride on the typewriter. I said, "No, don't know anything about that, that's for sure." So he said, "Can you ride at all?" Well, I got a little bit scared the way he talked to me, so I said, "Well, I can hunt and pick a little bit." So I landed in the offer, and I got a gasoline book, you know, to get gas anywhere, any standard oil station, and an automobile any time, because I had to learn to make the payrolls, and I didn't know any more about making payrolls than a man in the moon. So anyway, I was the luckiest guy, because that's what we got the payroll down at the end of the month. I got a 3-day pass, and I could go anywhere where I wanted to. I had a regular pass all the time. So as I say, I was the luckiest guy that went in, and believe me, when I saw what some of the boys took, I still contend that was, I think I had about as nice a time in the Army as I ever had anywhere. Well, they had a general strike. I was in just a year, and they had a general strike in Seattle. If you all remember, I don't know if they forget, the spring of 19. It was the spring of May. So they sent us over there to, I had, remember the little red thing to put on your arm when they discharged you? I had that on my blouse and everything, and I'd be done if it didn't take us back in and send us to Seattle. And he sent me to dispatch these trucks. The best thing I did was put 6 tons of butter on one of those Kelly trucks and went through the sidewalk. And the old man said, "You don't know anything about this." And I said, "Believe me, I know that." So he sent me back to tank, and my discharge was all right. I could go because I'd already practically gotten it. So I went over to Seattle, and the officer that was over at camp, he wanted me to stay in, and I said, "Oh yeah, but I'd just like to make a little trip over to Seattle before." So when I got over there, I saw where the Alaska Steamship Company was leaving, I don't know, in a couple of the steamer, Alaska, of the Alaska Steamship Company. So I went and got a ticket, but in the meantime, when I got my pay, I'd be $100.62. And there was the quickest little truck driver in the outfit that you ever saw. I said, "Fred, give me that 62 cents and go in with me when I get a bag out." And if that little devil didn't give me $51, I'd be run on that. Now, it's the first time he ever hadn't stolen it from anybody. And $5 he gave it to me. Well, I had $150. And there were three or four fellows that had gone. When I went to Seattle over with Folders and Sailors Club, there were fellows around there that had gotten their money and had gone busted. I think the deal was $50, didn't they? Well, 60, yeah. And so we business said, I thought, I've got to get out of here. I'll be in the same boat. So I bought my ticket and paid for it. And there were two or three other fellows that came the stage. And I was kind of helping them out. But there was a bunch from that bitter rod, Johnny Beaton and the fellow that married the Black Bear afterwards. I can't think of his name. And those fellows, he brought the roll out from the bitter rod. But anyway, they had a little penny on the game. And by golly, I did pretty well at that. So, golly, I was packing me. But in the meantime, there was a road man from Juneau that had canceled out, and I got his bunk in this with two other fellas. And so I'd loaded over these birds down in the stage, you know, they'd come up and holler at me, give me a beer or something like that, and I'd say, "Don't you fellas act like you know me. I don't want to know any of you." And I'd just lord it over me. But anyway, we got in the field, and then we went to Anchorage, and I well remember that trip. We rode to 45 mile, and then we walked and ran, because Anchorage was full of people and no beds. Well, I hadn't, we'd stopped drilling right after the armistice, and this was in April, the following April, and we hadn't done a thing, you know, in the way of drilling, and Lord, we ran up and down, we ran down the hill, you know, when you got to 45, around where the leap is. Well, we ran down that hill and walked into Anchorage. The next day, I couldn't get out of bed. My legs were so doggone sore, and they gave us a bank. Well, I don't think anybody was able to die because nobody could, well, none of us could walk. We hadn't done a thing. And they were treating us pretty nice. They were, I know old Frank Redwood at the Crescent Hotel. He said, "Now, if you guys haven't got any money, why, you're welcome to come in and stay in until you get some money." Well, I went up to the mines. We all went down to the employment office of the railroad, and so I went up to the Eskimo mines, and that was the spring and summer of 19. Well, I was there until I was there all that winter. Yes, in the fall. And then I went up. To Talkeetna, where a fellow had a cabin there, and I knew that I could stay there because I wanted to get to digging, and this fellow kept me on the haulage. And by golly, I said, "Well, I'm going to quit." Well, I wasn't so good that he was going to keep me on, so he let me quit, and I went up to Talkeetna, then that winter, this fellow Tom Owens, a fellow there, and I traded him to Anchorage. There was a Spokane copper outfit that had some ground up the Talkeetna River and then on the left limit of Anchorage. And we went up there and talked about sheep. That was the greatest sheep country that I've ever seen. And there was an ideal setup there was a shelf about, 2,000 or 3,000 feet up on the mountain that is about 30 or 40 feet wide. And when it snowed, that's the difference what it does in that country. I've seen it snow 4 feet in the 24 hours over there. Well, the sheep would come down until the blow came. So, by golly, we'd get up there, and the one of us would get at one end of this thing, and the other end at the other, and when we meet, well, there were 15 or 20 sheep. So, by that was the best place for, and I guess it's all gone now because many people hunting over there. Well, I've been over there for years anyway. And they were terribly there too. But then when I came back down, I went back over to the mines again. And Jonesville had gotten started then, so they shut down the Eskimo and the government did and took coal from Jonesville and transferred off up to Chickaloon. But in the meantime, I'd met my wife, she was Esther Oliver then, she came up there to teach school. So At last I went up to the dry house. They took two or three of us out of the mine to come down freeze. The miners chipped in and built a schoolhouse. That's what I should have started with in the beginning. So they had a special train from Anchorage, and my lord, they came out there, and we had 10 or 12 freezers of ice cream, and they took some of us out of the mine to freeze the ice cream that winter. Some was here. Does anybody remember him? You probably do, Ford. You do, sure. He's a mining engineer at the head of the mines over there. So, by golly, when I got up to the dry house after the bridges had come off ship, I remember the new school mine. I said, by golly, fellas, that's the biggest woman I ever saw in my life. Well, by golly, I guess somebody told him all that, because believe me, she kind of looked down her nose at me for quite a while. And we were transferred up to Chickaloon, and we went on a strike up there. And Dan Sutherland was back in Washington then as our delegate, and I voted for a Republican that time, by golly, because Dan went to the Navy and tried to get $5 diggers from Butte. They'd come over digging coal in Washington, and they were going to import them for $5 a shift. Well, good Lord. We went on strike and there were 20 of us, took a station contract up above the Gold Creek. We had 2,000 feet there and a big trap and 4 head of horses, and we really did well by doing it. And then they imported a lot of miners from Washington to dig coal, and those diggers went on strike. When the Washington scale went up, they went on strike. So the foreman fired all those boys in front of the Seattle and wired up and down the road for us to come back, and they'd pay us what they were going to pay them. So that was, we got $8.75 an hour on an 8-hour shift, and I just think what a cool day it makes now. And Carpenter, he makes that in an hour and a half, that 8 to 60 a shift. But anyway, I stayed there till, in 1922, Washington shut it down. There was too much Republican money back yonder in those Pennsylvania coal fields. So they said that they didn't want to find too much coal up in Alaska. So anyway, they shut it down. So we all went down the line, and Ms. Hulk, Esther Alvis, right, came in, so we were married, everybody here is married, of course, but I took a room at 2 different hotels in Anchorage, because those devils were loading for me, all those diggers, you know. So I took a room at 2 different hotels, and I picked off the parsons. That's where we stayed that night. And I said, now, for Lord's sake, don't get these birds off, because they just give me a bad time, I know. So they didn't. Those devils the next morning, they sure went after me. So you say, that's my mind. So they wanted the timekeeper in here on this bridge at the new manor. So I went down, I knew only pulled up a few timekeepers, so he sent me in, and Ms. Hall was teaching school up at the Chickaloon, so she finished out her year, and then they came in. Well, after we got the railroad put in the piers, that's all they did, the American Bridge Company they fabricated the steel and put it up and everything. So Bartley Howard was a big building foreman of a gang, and he went to Curry to put up the roundhouse in the hotel there. So I went down there with him after we got up. Then Gainesville caught a fire, and they wired up and down the railroad for diggers to come back to Esker, that they had to open up the mines again. So he pulled out and went back over to Esker, because that, I think, was the nicest camp the leader of him, anyway. Everything was fine, and that's one place. Well, a man and a man came up, and I always thought, if ever I ran a camp anywhere, of course, I don't know where I did, but Mr. Smith used to say, now, mister, you're up here, and we're very glad to have you and your family. But the minute that your wife starts to make any trouble in camp, you just come in and get your time, because I don't want to have to fire you, because you know about it. So you just come in and get your time and take it, and then we'll still be friends. So. But we had a picture show down there, and for kids it was 2 bits, and for grown people 50 cents. Fish were 12 and a half cents a piece. And they just come inside the door and throw the fish over in the corner, you know, and they'd go in. That was their entree into the show, and the old folks would bring the 4 fish. The little kids would bring 2 fish, and so that was a funny thing. But we had it was a pretty good show. Of course, it wasn't talkers, but we had 2 dates a year. That was on Friday and Saturday nights. We had shows, and all that those film had to come in on the last boat in the latter part of August, and then we kept them all winter. Except this outfit once in a while. That was 4 talkers were so general. That was 1929, where you all would know that the talkers weren't too plentiful in Alaska then. And occasionally they'd wire in and say, send out Phil so-and-so, that they wanted, or somebody else wanted it. So we'd send it out, of course. But that was the strangest thing, you know, when people had come down. There were lots of people travel through there, because Bethel, that whole country drained into Bethel. And these people, see these people in, they said, when the devil did they throw that? I said, they couldn't get in the show if they didn't. And of course, they smell to high heaven, you know, but you get used to that smell too, I'll tell you. But the company had four posts around that. They had one at Kugelingok, and one at Kipnuk, and one at Chokot Polygamy, and one at Tununuk. That's right on Nelson Island. So every spring, I'd go and take inventory at all these places. We had a trader at each place. Johnny Dell was at Kugelingok, and he was there all the time. We had these native traders. So, when you started down there, you'd put a compass on the handlebar, and that's what you went by. You didn't have any trail. That country down there, as you know, it was just as flat as that for 100 miles, not a sign of anything. So you'd put a compass on, and that's what you drove your dog to, by the compass. And we stopped the first night at Kynak, and there was a fellow by the name of Petalewski there, who was a Moravian. He's the fellow that guided the boat, the pilot, from the mountain. You see, a Bethel was 65 miles from the Bering Sea up, and that was right on the river, and this Petalewski, the ocean boat came right up. So we would stop there, and stay there, and then we'd go on down to Johnny's place at Kugelingok. But I had another experience that we got in a blow. And the dogs wouldn't face it. We each had a dog team. The dogs were saying, we just bogged down. I had a sheepskin sleeping bag that Frank Wiseman had made up at McGrath and had it down there. Well, I bought it from him. He was the U.S. Marshal there. So we just laid up for 2 days, and by golly, you just ate out of your grub box. You couldn't keep a promise over, you couldn't keep the blaze on it. And it was blowing snow, you couldn't see, and the dogs couldn't face it, so we laid up. And of course, then that country down there thawed. It'd be just like rain, that snow, so. And the first thing I learned was when we went to bed at night to lay this way instead of this way, because if you got covered up with that snow, you'd never get out by evening. And Johnny said, always, now you're learning that, this fellow Dolan. He said, never lay side by side down here on this tundra country. So we got the Kipnuk and the Jameses. You all remember the Jameses that the Japs, when they landed on that too, they took them over? Well, they were at the Kipnuk. And they had a brand new school building. Beautiful thing. Down there, sitting down there in the tundra, you could see it 40 miles by the big building up. So they had a spare room. So Ms. Jones told us that we were welcome to this room to hang up our stuff to dry. You can imagine the weight of that sheep sleeping bag that I had. So we hung our stuff up, and we're going to stay there till it dried. And they were mighty nice people, the Jones were. She was as pretty as a picture, by Jane. And So she called us one morning, said, y'all got a minute? So we went in, and she had a little boy hadn't come to school for a couple of days, so she put the dew hat on. And then she shook him, you know, and by golly, she got the dustpan, and I bet she got 1,000 little wigglers or that puffed off the floor of the dew hat, you know, knock them out, and they'd fall off. So that was just 2 days now, he hadn't been to school, and he was that lousy when he got back, so you can imagine what the rest of them were. But we were there when the needlefish had run. Now, I've never heard of any other place where these needlefish run, although they may. They're about that long, and they've got, they call them needles. Well, they aren't too sharp, but there are three or four of them right down their backbone. And they run up the Skipnuck River. And the natives cut a great big hole in the ice, and they had big, well, we'd call it a scoop. It's just like a ladle, only it's about 6 feet across and has a long stick on it, and there's a net in there, you know. And they say because they're very small. And school was out that day, and all the little boys were gathered around the hole, and when they'd bring up a dip net, all that got out, the little boys were to grab them, you know, and they'd break their back and eat them raw, you know. Well, I tried that too, but I didn't like that very much either. So, there were 40 or 50 dog teams there, and all of them would get 3 or 4 cartons and go back home, because down there, all those people, their lives at that time were spent trying to get wood and trying to get something together to trade in for something to eat. Now, that's the way they lived, and Lord, there were lots of old men down there, so they must have done pretty well at it. But they had a blackfish down there that lived in those tundra lakes. And they'd freeze in. And by golly, the natives had cut out a chunk, you know, a foot square, and poured into a pot. And by golly, when that ice melted, those doggone fish would jump out of there. They'd come back to life. if they lost their life, I don't know. But anyway, but they didn't have much substance. They looked just like a whale, but they were really about that big. But they didn't have much oil in them. But these needlefish, boy, you could light one of them with a match, and boy, did they go after that. I know we were up. We had gotten on further, and we were cooking dinner one night up at Chilcross Polygamy. And this native boy came, and Johnny asked him to eat with us. And he saw this carton of these needlefish out there. You think you could get him past them? I should say that he wasn't having any time for what we had to eat. I don't know how many of those things he ate, but we had 2 or 3 cartons of them with us. And, you know, and Johnny was a trader, and he'd go ever so often, and they'd come into this trading post with their mink or whatever they had, white stuff. But you know, those old boys down there, the old men, they take a sled and put 2 or 3 fish on it and a little piece of reindeer skin or something, and they'd get on a fox trailer, they'd follow him for a week. Didn't make any difference to them. Their time wasn't worth anything, so they just the first one I saw, I stopped. I was ahead of Johnny. And I said, what in the devil, Johnny, is that fellow doing? Well, he's on the trail of a fox. Well, I said, how do you mean on the trail? He said, Dick, he'll just follow that fox. If it takes a week, why, he'll run him down, but he'll just keep on, you know. And of course, they shoot him down there. There's no way to trap him, because they haven't got anything to tie a trap chain to. So, anyway, we went on. And then that's the first place that I ever made 70 miles a day with a dog team. But in that country down there, you could if you got started early enough, you know. If you didn't get off the compass, well, you would get somewhere before the day was over. But I often thought about what happened to a man if he got down there alone, wouldn't, and what the devil he'd do, which way to go. But that was interesting company. Those natives from Nunavak Island, the women are, lots of them are 6 feet tall. Big, fine-looking women, and they've got, all of them got those amulets. No, that's not what they call them. But anyway, they got them in, all of them had that. And, to see them come up the river with their sails up, you know, and all different colors of calico, and you know, they'd get this canvas and dye, it was pretty. And they would be 15 or 20 boats. I know that we had a trader over there, old Eskimo, and he was just a little guy. But he'd take, we bought 80 pokes of seal oil there every year from The main mercantile company, I can't think of that fellow's name, but he'd bring us... Rank, that's right. He'd come over with this seal, and we'd buy 80 folks, and there was a little boy there, Black Nick. And these folks, how they do, they put the blubber in there, and then put them out in the sun, and the sun melts it, and it goes to oil, you know, and of course, if they stand too long, where they get sour or strong or whatever, and that Black Nick, by golly, they turned the seal, the hair in, and put the fat in there, and then they tie some around each arm and each leg, you know, and Black Nick would unwind that string and let a little of that seal oil out in the cup, and he tested every one of those babies right there. I watched him, and he tested every one of them, by golly. Now, just think of that, of drinking at least 2 or 3 tablespoons out of 80 of those. Oh, my Lord, love it. Well, it was simply easing out of his ears, by Jimmy. And we put those folks down in water and keep you covered all the time, because the minute you let them out and the sun would burn them a little bit, the stuff would get rancid. And, pretty rancid is right. Well, of course, it was rancid for me anyway. It didn't make a difference whether the sun had hit it or not, by golly. Golly Moses, I tried to eat everything in sight down there, and I've got a pretty good stomach too, but I couldn't stomach some of that, that was too rough. Well, our boys are getting big enough to, you know, the competition. We had wonderful teachers down there, the Finners were, but they could just only move so fast, you know, with the children, and after kids got up around 12, 13, or 14, in the wintertime, they'd come to school, because that was the only warm place, you know. And by golly, they'd all stay in school just as long as the teacher let them. I mean, 15, 20, anyway, any time, they'd still go to school, you know, to get a warm place where it's cold. But I'd tried to get, and I'd written the home office and, you know, tried to get out of there if I could. Well, Mr. Richmond didn't want to send me up here to Jump County, the auditor was there. So I got a wire from Tony Diamond from Ketchikan, and the contents of the wire were, if Joe McDonald would be appointed the United States Marshal at Fairbanks, would you come up to Fairbanks as his chief deputy? I forgot to tell you that Tony had gotten weathered in there. They didn't go just any time like they do now, for instance. And he was there for 10 days. He stayed with us, me being the only Democrat in the town. Lars, I got to tell you this, and Charlie Luke was a commissioner down there, and he was appointing people for the 1930 election. That was the in-between election, you know, and I thought, I've got time to waste a day at that. I don't mean wasted, but I just haven't got the time to do it. Well, if you're the only man in town that's damn fool enough to be a Democrat, you've got to serve, by goodness. So I said, well, under those conditions, I'll serve them. So I did. But Tony wired me from Ketchikan. He had gotten stuck there, and he stayed at our house, and he's a very fine gentleman, as all of you know, the new Tony Diamond. And Richie was there, the auditor, and I said, Sid, I don't think I can make a living in Fairbanks on those government wages. Well, why don't you try it? You could always go back to work for the company, and it might be that the lightning might strike, and you'd... Well, I said, all right. So I wired Tony that I would, and I hadn't heard of Joe McDonald, let alone me. So by Jimmy, I got a wire from Joe, wanting me to come up as a chief. So I wired the home office, and Oscar Hall, who wasn't any kin of mine, was a man from St. Michael. He had come in with the Signal Corps years ago. He was there helping me in the store. So I turned the store over to him, and flew in with Harry Blunt. And the PAA manager, Peck, wasn't there a Peck? Is that the manager of the PAA here? He'd been hunting down there somewhere, and I got on that plane, and we went down through Dillingham in that way. That's the first time I ever rode on one of those old planes, and I guess it took us an hour and a half to get off down there on Lake Iliamna. We were too heavily loaded, I guess, but anyway, we made it in Anchorage. I flew on up here to Fairbanks with Clark Bassett, who, by the way, is dead. Did any of you fellas know Clark? At noon. Yeah, that's where he was born at noon. The boys, all of them were. But Clark died last year. And So, Al Munson was the pilot. They were actually ferrying a plane from Anchorage to Fairbanks. And of course, Al's gone on too many years back. So, I went up and Joe was appointed shortly after I got up there, and I was a chief deputy. Well, then that's when they had this 10% economy thing or 15% economy thing. So I told Joe, I said, well, Joe, I'm going back to the Crick's. I said, heck, I can't make a living at Crick's. Well, if you remember, Teddy Nordale was appointed clerk of the court by Harry Pratt, and he got killed on that trip with Johnny Long from Dawson back here on Discovery Day. Well, then Harry appointed Ainer. Ainer had been in the country in the office then for 12 or 14 years, I think, and then he appointed Ainer as clerk and told him that he would appoint him for a year. And then he appointed me as a clerk, and then I was there for 24 years in the office. And then, of course, you all know when it happened that when Lever made a state, Mr. President Eisenhower appointed that judge down there that wasn't known. Can't think of his name. But anyway, appointed him the judge, and then then Croninger, who was his clerk, he naturally made clerk. Well, then I automatically retired from federal service, and I lacked 6 days of having 34 years in. That is counting my work on the railroad and then my 1 year war in the service, and then in the clerk's office, and then I went with the state court, but if you all are pardoning it, they didn't have court reporters, but they had those damn machines, and they ran me off the job. The more I fiddled with them, the more I disliked them. So, and the guys are fighting them now. I go up every now and commiserate with them, I feel sorry for them and all like that. But now, some of them like it, but I didn't. I didn't like that machine at all, by Junior, because there's just one little quirk to that thing. If you take a man on the stand that doesn't talk cleanly, if the trainee that's examining him doesn't tell him to say it over again, that machine doesn't tell him. And when they appeal and somebody tries to get a transcript of what he said, well, gee, whiz, that's just dynamite, and I didn't want any part of that. Somebody coming back onto me and saying, "Did you didn't get that right?" Well, I wouldn't know whether I got it right or not, because, Lord love us, unless you had about five machines, and I don't know. But anyway, so I terminated on June the 30th, and then I made my, that's all, I was out the first time in 25 years. And by golly, if I had seen a sister in Los Angeles, I haven't seen her for 45 years, so I thought I'd better go and see her before I lost my parents when I was 8 months old, and there were six children, and I know, I've heard it since, you know, what people say, well, now, isn't that too bad now? Here's this family, not grown up. But in those days, well, I guess all the kinfolks kind of looked out after the rest of the kinfolks, because I stayed with the family of one of my aunts, and there were two aunts in the house, and they had a boy, and I was fortunate enough that those folks treated me just the same as if I was their own flesh and blood. Well, I was, of course, but I mean as if I was their own son. And they had just one son, and the son rose and said to him that they treated me, and I've seen things that I've seen since. Brother, I thought how fortunate I was. Now I think I've run off the mouth here long enough for you all, and I'm very glad that I could. And if you got tired, well, as I told somebody once when I got up to speak, I said, now I'm not going to feel bad if somebody just gets up and say, "Did you talk long enough? Let's quit this." So I wouldn't have felt bad if somebody had said that, by golly. So that's the end, by golly. I flew down, and Mrs. Hall went outside and spent the summer with her mother. She came in on the tupper, the old tupper. And all the cows and pigs and everything else were right up on deck, you know, and everybody lived together, by goodness. You're liable to find anything. Then But that's rather interesting, too. When this hall came out, you will use the tramway across from the Yukon over to the Crystal Crim. She and the boys and Carl I. Carlson, who had a store at Apias, they made the last trip of that ferry, of that trip across there. They pulled those boats up Mud Creek, and then there was a lake right on top that they ran across with a motor. They pulled the boats actually up this Mud Creek, but it'd slip on the mud pretty good. You couldn't run a motor in it. And then they'd go down on the other side into Holy Cross. But that was the last trip that they made. But you know, it's funny to me when I hear these people talk about the senior New Nana, one of the old seniors on the river. Well, that's a teacup about New Nana is compared with the most of them, you know. And those kind of things bring me up, but I don't say anything about it. You're just an old fogey trying to live in the days gone by. So I don't say anything more about it anymore. Well, I used to make me mad. But... Well, now, it couldn't be any machine. When I was there, in 22. Well, yes, it could be that old, all right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the Jacobs and the Davis, as you know, Forbes, were the boats then. I didn't know that boat couldn't be that old. That boat couldn't be that old, this new Nana, huh? All right, well, by the name of the new Nana? How old do you say it is?
About 36.
Couldn't be that old.
Well, it's 5 years old,
and
I worked on it in
37, 38.
I figured out.
Well, I still don't think it's that old.
I
throw
the bottom up, and
the
sure that
screw's
come back.
But
the bottom doesn't make it 33.
I didn't realize it was that old.
I don't believe it is, either. It's built by the railroad.
That's right.
Delivering equipment on
37. Well, that's possible.
They do.
That was a strange situation. But
that. Somebody told me that when I first went out, and I was about to finish fire, and I thought that was another one of those sea jobs.
Well, they don't do it. Well, you've got a way to tie your trap down up here, but down there, there's not a thing in the world, you know, to.
Well, he told me to get on the trail and stay with it and eventually catch
up. Yeah. But you know, that time isn't worth anything. I've known natives to drive from that coast country up to Bethel. And bring a moose skin and trade it in for a pound of black bull tobacco and turn around and go back down on the coast. Now that's what their time is worth. That's right. A dollar's worth of tobacco, of a pound of black bull.
Well,
Sam was quite a fellow, but he put up his.
Special sales from New York and old stuff years old. And they come in the field and say it's a good fox skin or a good moose skin for probably a
30 cent half. Well, I landed at the Bethel at a good time. We were paying $50 and $55 and $60 for a mink, and the mink were up around $40. And of course, in 1929, when I went down there in October, you know what happened that year, by golly. When I got down there, you couldn't give a skin away, by golly. Yeah, and I know that whoever used to write me, "Where's your requisition?" Thing requisition, and the thing that I wrote to them was, "You're way overstocked down here now for what it looks like to me." And Lord, they hadn't. That drained an enormous country, and a lot of the traders that would run out of stuff. But golly, Moses, they hadn't enormous stock down there, and it wasn't even. There was natives wooden traps. It wasn't worth anything. Well, they were drug on the market, I know that.
Do you remember the
festival?
Why were they heading down there
to Texas? No, that was before my day. But this Tom Contest, this kid that was killed, I knew his dad very well, old Tom, but that boy wasn't born when I was down there. You see, we've been away from there since 33. Well, that's about 30 years now, you know. So that boy wasn't born then, but his dad was a very nice fellow. And so many of those traders down there were married to native women, and But those Eskimo boys, when it came to, I remember when about the second plane came into Bethel, the next morning all the little native kids were out whittling out airplanes, and boy, they said putting their whittling just like they looked, and believe me, and they'd been there all the time. But they were mechanics. I've seen them bring those Johnson motors in. Of course, as I say, Phil said it was worth before I got down there, and from 25, 26 on, up to 29, every little Johnson.